From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. What a long, strange trip it has been, but now the polls are open, and it is up to us, all of us, to determine what the next chapter of American politics will be.
My name is Nyana Brown. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I like to vote on the actual election day just because I know it's kind of weird, but I feel like my vote actually counts that day. And I could take off work for that day just because I have to vote, so might as well do it on Tuesday.
If you're like Nyana, that today is your day, tell us about your voting booth experience on election day. Share your arguments for why it's important to make your voice heard in this election. Here are your first thoughts, or some of them. Suzanne Miller from St. Simons Island emailed us. She's a California transplant who's lived in South Georgia for 6 years, and she says, quote, "Being blue in a red state is rather stressful. Unfortunately, I've found it pointless to bring my views up. It's very sad that with all the ugly distractions, we have not been able to be excited about the fact of a woman being a major candidate. I voted early. It was easy and a relief of sorts. I've been up and down, but feel confident about tomorrow." She's talking about today. On Facebook, Matthew Thornton writes, "It comes down to what you personally value in life. For instance, say you value being annoying to people. Folks on the your vote doesn't matter side are annoyed by the opportunity costs of participating in an election and then loathe the fact that you vote. Other people are annoyed by potential voters who sit out elections. Depending on how many acquaintances you have on a given side, you can find great satisfaction in doing the opposite action." So Matthew Thornton's getting deep with us. You can give us your deep thoughts as well. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Justice Department will watch over voting in Fulton, Gwinnett, and Hancock counties today. The department will be on the lookout for election fraud and threats of violence and intimidation at polling places. Efforts like that to protect voter rights can be traced back to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Intentional attempts to decrease voter turnout in certain communities still a problem here in Georgia. Christina Torres has been reporting on this for the AJC. She joins me this morning. Good to have you, Christina.
Good morning. Happy Election Day.
Yes, happy Election Day to you as well. And also with us is University of Georgia political science professor Charles Bullock. Good to have you as well.
Thank you.
Charles, can you tell us, what does voter intimidation actually look like? What do we mean when we say that?
Well, if we go back in history, we would find people who would show up at a voting place and sometimes were armed and would actually turn away voters. If we were to go back, say, to that 1946 heavily contested election in Georgia, that was fairly pervasive. Now, we don't see things like that anymore. We've made a great deal of progress, and for most people, there's absolutely no problem going to vote.
So, Christina, what do we see now? What are these things that the Department of Justice is going to be watching for?
Well, it's important to note the monitors are going to three locations in Georgia. So it's Fulton County, Gwinnett County, and Hancock County, where there have been allegations of alleged voter suppression over the last probably about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And these are monitors. They're not observers, and it gets a little nerdy to explain the difference, but observers actually can go in and take action. Monitors are there to observe. They're looking to make they're outside the polling location. They're looking to make sure that everything's in order, no one's reporting being denied the right to vote, for example. If you don't have ID, you can cast a provisional ballot, making sure things like that happen. And they're also looking to make sure there aren't, in this election of rhetoric, that there aren't, maybe someone outside the polling location, waving a sign or shouting at someone or, threatening to take a photo of someone's license plate. It's just making sure that there's an orderly way to vote and that you can access your right to vote on this day.
Okay, so a number of places, including the New York Times, have reported on what's happened what did happen in Sparta, Georgia. Reportedly, law enforcement visited the homes of mostly minority voters and challenged their right to vote. Your paper, the AJC, visited a majority black neighborhood in Macon, where a very popular polling location was closed down. Christine, is this considered voter intimidation? What does that classify under?
Certainly voting advocates believe it does. Sparta is in Hancock County, which we just talked about.
Right.
I was there a few weeks ago for a voter registration rally. And I know the mayor of Sparta believes that law enforcement, the sheriff's department, wasn't purposely trying to do anything, that they were following an order from the Board of Elections, the Hancock County Board of Elections, which was challenging the status of some voters, in this case, who happened to be black. It's a majority-minority county. Now, when that happens, you know, for advocates, an officer, you know, flags you down on the street or knocks on your door, it can be intimidating. It can be scary.
Yeah, it's scary.
You don't know if what you've done. You believe you didn't do anything wrong, and this person is telling you you have to go before the Board of Elections to prove you should be on the rolls. For advocates, that is voter intimidation. That could, you know, someone may interpret that as, well, it's not worth voting because I don't want to get questioned or stopped by law enforcement. In Macon Bibb County, there was a decision to move a polling location that was in a gym in a majority black neighborhood in Macon. There was some construction going on, according to election officials, and they didn't want there to be any problems with voting. They chose, or they suggested, that the location be moved to a sheriff's building nearby. And I know when I talked to the head of the local NAACP down there, she said, you know, hey, again, you know, folks may not have had the best interaction with law enforcement. She believes that her community has had problems with racial profiling by law enforcement. So they did not want to have to go to a sheriff's building to go vote because they were worried. In the end, in Macon Bibb County, they decided not to use the sheriff's building. They ended up using a church building. That precinct has actually been moved again to a different church building where it's now going to be permanently located. But advocates say, you know, the fact that they had to intervene shows a problem.
So, Charles, let me play you a clip from a reporter who tried to get some records from the Board of Elections in Hancock County. That's, again, includes the city of Sparta. And this is a clip of, I guess, while it's actually happening.
You're ejecting me from the Board of Elections for requesting to inspect records as you're required to under law. Okay, just walk away. Doesn't change what just happened. He just told me. I was just told in the Board of Elections meeting by a consultant to the Board of Elections that he could not give me the phone number of the board to call.
And ask him to remove this guy from the premises.
He's calling the sheriff to remove me from the premises for requesting to inspect a public record.
What's gone wrong here, to as far as you can tell, Charles? What is happening?
Yeah, clearly one has access or should have access to public records like that. And it's hard to come up with any kind of scenario under which that is not wrong what's being done there. One shouldn't have to go to court to seek a request or file a Freedom of Information Act request to get information like this. It's supposed to be readily available.
What do you think happens in these particular cases? Is it a lack of good information on the part of, say, sometimes officials? Maybe they're not entirely aware of what is a public record and what is not?
That may be part of it, right. And I guess public officials, all of us kind of like to control our environment, and we don't like when we get questioned about it. So I suspect that might be part of what was prompting the actions by the Board of Elections official there. But it's not excusable.
So, Christina, we got a message from the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, saying that they had investigated all allegations of voter fraud, voter irregularities, and they had found nothing wrong. And he also said that the number of claims that there were irregularities or possible fraud was average for this time of year. Is that what you have also seen in your reporting?
It is. And again, keeping in mind, this election has been extraordinary in terms of the rhetoric. Obviously, Republican nominee Donald Trump has talked about, you know, a rigged election and wanting his supporters to make sure that didn't happen or that there was no voter fraud. So I think the idea of fraud or a rigging an election is certainly high in the mind of voters and anyone who's not been able to escape this avalanche of news about the election. But I know the chief inspector for the Secretary of State's office yesterday said they had about 25 complaints for the fall. He said that was on par with what they had in 2012. You know, we do know that a couple of those complaints involve suggestions that machines were not calibrated properly, so they, you know, were quote-unquote flipping votes, people trying to vote for one person.
And it changed.
Machine showed a different person, and they had to go back and change it to correct the problem. You know, the good news is all the voters reporting that said they were able to correct the problem, that their votes were properly recorded. So the office is looking into a few complaints about that, but on average, they do appear to be normal compared to 2012.
And yet, Charles, from around the country, we have reports of other things which in some cases may depress the vote. For example, in Ohio, some people put the wrong date. They put 2015 instead of 2016. And even though they're, indisputably registered, eligible voters, those votes will be thrown out. In Texas, and even frankly here in Georgia, we've seen photos of signs around different communities saying you don't need photo ID and you very much do so. How do we classify those kind of things? Is that also voter intimidation?
No, I don't know what it'd be voter intimidation. It sounds like to me just voter misinformation. Anyway, we have those things. Yeah, those are fairly common things. There have been stories in the past about where, you know, one party, you know, sends out information that because of overcrowded polling that the other party is going to vote on Wednesday. So those kinds of things happen. Well-informed, better-educated voters are the ones who can kind of clearly step up and correct those things on the ground, just as Christina was talking about. If you've noticed that somehow the machine is not calibrated properly and it flips your vote, you know, call over the local election official, make sure you get that corrected before you leave the voting place.
So, Christina, as the DOJ sends personnel to monitor the elections here, what are you expecting? Do you feel as though the Secretary of State is ready for what is expected to be a very busy day? And what do voters do if they think they are being intimidated?
Well, the Secretary of State's office and everyone related to that, so it goes on down through Kennesaw State has the election center where they help run the elections,
right,
and oversee the machines, all the way through to local election officials. I can tell you they've been training and preparing for this for a year.
Yeah.
So they certainly feel they are ready. I know in talking to the Secretary of State's office yesterday, in terms of preparing for election night reporting, so once polls close and the reports and the counts start coming in, you know, they have gone through, I think, every scenario they can think of in terms of trying to make sure, for example, if there's an internet outage, what do they do to get the results out, you know, making sure that they've got, you know, their firewalls and internal systems in place to protect against this idea of hacking, for example,
yeah,
that we've heard so much about. So I certainly think they feel they are absolutely prepared. They've been planning for this, you know, as I said, for a year since December. They've been training for this. You know, it's election day. There will be some hiccups. There will be
yeah,
a precinct where machines will go down for a few minutes or an hour. And that happens.
But hopefully.
And they have policies and processes in place,
right,
to deal with that. So, you know, what I can say is so far, so good. You know,
and the polls have been only been open for two hours.
I know. Fingers crossed.
Right. Christina Torres, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Charles Bullock is a professor of political science at the University of Georgia. Thanks so much to both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
A record number of people went through early voting. We talked to some of them at Georgia State University.
My name is Esteban Rosa from Atlanta, Georgia.
We was wild out there, really. It was a lot. There was a lot of people out there. It was about 100 plus. And it was kind of like you can kind of see who was voting for Trump because it was usually white and angry, and everybody else was voting for Hillary. So it was a pretty good experience, I would say. It was like a different vibe than when Barack Obama, when you voted for him. Is a way different vibe because nobody wants to be there. They have to be there so that way Trump doesn't get in office.
My name is India Kelly and I'm from Gulfport, Mississippi. It was very like different and eye-opening. It was my first time voting in an election, and of course like the presidents were very important to me, but really the amendments, being educated as well, was eye-opening.
My name is Brandon Stokes. I'm from Augusta, Georgia.
To be honest, actually, that was my first time voting, so it really was like an overwhelming feeling. Like, at first, I went in confidence. I just felt like it was like a normal thing, but after I realized, like, wow, I just put my faith into the ballot of, like, determining how the United States is about to run in the next couple of years, and it was like an immense, great feeling.
They are armed, sometimes heavily, but how dangerous are they? Some militia groups have formed in large numbers around the country. The Southern Poverty Law Center found anti-government militia groups grew by more than a third last year. We talked about that with some of the groups themselves based right here in Georgia last month, and tensions tied to the election have empowered some to be a little more outspoken. New York Times reporter David Zucchino recently visited the Georgia Security Force. That's one of our state's most vocal militia groups, and David joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
Why the Georgia Security Force? Why did you focus on that one?
Well, I had called around to many militias and various so-called 3% groups and other extremist groups. The idea was to try to get with one of these groups and spend some time with them and just listen to them, let them talk, find out what motivates them, why they say the things that they do and do the things they do. And many of the militias that I contacted just didn't respond at all. Some said we don't talk to the news media. And finally, I ended up with the Georgia Security Force, they said, yeah, you can come on down. We're having what they call a field training exercise where they go out and do these sort of paramilitary drills and do live fire exercises. So that's how I ended up with them.
So let's hear a little bit. This is from a video posted last year by the Georgia Security Force. This was one of the groups that protested the building of a mosque here in Noonan, Georgia, earlier this year. In this video, they're speaking to ISIS. They're declaring war on ISIS.
We are the predators, you the prey. The rivers will run red with the blood of those who target Americans. May you hear the rolling thunder of vengeance, and may it strike fear into the hearts of those who terrorize in the name of the false god Allah. We are coming for you, ISIS. You don't f*** with our Marines.
So you mentioned 3% militia. What does that mean first? What is a 3% group?
These groups believe that only 3% of the colonists actually took up arms and fought in the Revolutionary War. Now, historians say that's not correct, but it's very useful for these groups. I mean, their whole mentality is wrapped around a small but dedicated few people with weapons can overcome tyranny, and tyranny they define very broadly.
Why would a group like this Georgia Security Force think that it is on them to declare a war on ISIS? In other words, where's the place for the U.S. military among a group like this?
Yeah, exactly, and it's ironic because Chris Hill, who is the leader of this group, who formed this group, is a Marine veteran, and a lot of the things they do are sort of predicated on Marine basic training. They feel that with particularly a Democratic administration and someone like Hillary Clinton or even under President Obama, that the military is not effective. The military will not protect them, and they have to take up arms on their own to protect what they call our way of life.
So let's hear a comment from Ryan Lenz. He's a senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's also editor of the Hate Watch blog. And he's talking about how this election may influence the growth or shrinkage, I guess, of militias.
In times of Democratic presidencies, militia groups tend to skyrocket. We saw that with the election of President Barack Obama. Anti-government groups, of which militias are a part, rose to historic levels, upwards of over 1,200 groups in the nation. So it really all depends on which direction the people that populate these militias feel the country is going. Is it going in the direction of the federal government coming for our guns in the wake of all these mass shootings?
What did you hear from those you spoke to, David? Because some people say that the militia groups are racially motivated. And this sounds like Ryan Lenz of the Southern Poverty Law Center is hinting that it's actually Democrats they're worried about because of gun policies. What is it? What is at the heart of it?
For this particular group, their number one issue is guns, and they are convinced that if Hillary Clinton is elected, that she will, quote, come for our guns. And I asked them, well, you said the same thing about President Obama. You know, he hasn't come to take your guns. And they said, well, that's only because we have gotten out our weapons. We have been very visible. We've been vigilant, and we've managed to fight him off. Now we're going to have to fight off Hillary Clinton. Their other big issue is Muslims. They're extremely Islamophobic. They have a lot of hate talk directed at Muslims and particularly Syrian refugees. They are convinced that Syrian refugees are hiding ISIS members and that any Syrians who have gotten in have set up secret training camps around the U.S. And their third issue, I would say, is immigration in general. They're very much for building a wall across the Mexican border. They say immigrants come and take their jobs and threaten their way of life.
In the piece, you quote one of the militia members saying, "We won't fire first." What does that mean?
They call themselves a defensive militia. They say that they would not take the weapons out and fire at anyone, that they would fire only if attacked. And I had an interesting experience as soon as I got there. It was on a Friday evening. They had set up what they called a checkpoint, and it was on a driveway on private property, but it was right next to a highway. And apparently somebody had called in and complained that there was a bunch of guys walking around with loaded weapons. So two sheriff's deputies pulled up and sort of half blocked the highway with their cars, got out behind their doors, had their automatic rifles ready, and were obviously very concerned about these guys running around with guns, and yelled through the loudspeaker, through their loudspeakers, saying, "Put down the guns." And this group was very agitated and complained about their Second Amendment rights. They eventually put their guns down and talked to the officers, and everything was okay. But then when I talked to them after, they said, "Look, you can see now people, even the local sheriff's deputies are after our guns. People don't want us to have guns, and we've got to fight for our rights."
I mean, I have to wonder why, how you felt going in here. I mean, we just saw photos yesterday of a shirt that up until, I guess, a few hours ago was being sold on Zazzle, where it said "Rope, Tree, Journalist, Some Assembly Required." How did you feel? Did you feel safe going to report on this story?
I felt safe, but it was a little unnerving getting into this kind of paranoid mentality, this sort of alternative reality that these people live in. And I was very aware that they are highly critical of the news media. I had several of them tell me, you know, the news media is part of the whole Clinton campaign. They want Hillary to win. They've helped rig the election. No offense to you personally.
But you're with the New York Times. You're
right,
one of the more hated...
Well, yeah, the New York Times and CNN seem to be their big targets. And they said, "Well, you know, you're talking to us now. I know you're going to twist our words." You know, I tried to say, "I'm here just to listen to you." And my feeling is all I have to do is quote them directly, and that'll take care of it. People can judge for themselves. I don't think I need to twist their words.
So we spoke with Charles Keith Cottle, who's a militia member in the Southeast, and he admits there are a few rare members that take the ideology too far.
There are radicals out there that, like anything, like one cop can give up a bunch of cops a bad name. We all know that, you know, one bad apple doesn't reflect that of the entire police department or the entire militia, and occasionally that will happen with anything, but we try our best to prevent it in advance.
What did you hear in terms of, I guess, what this militia does to limit far what he's talking about, radicals, to keep things under control and calm?
I will say that they were very, very focused on gun safety, and they went through a whole lot of safety measures before they even started firing. In fact, they walked through these drills four or five times without weapons. They said that anyone who had whose weapon went off accidentally would be asked to leave. So from that point of view, I think they are safety-oriented. Now, as far as somebody taking a gun on their own and doing something, I have no idea. I did check with the sheriff's offices in two of the counties around there, and they were aware of this group, but they said they aren't aware of any of the members being arrested or convicted on any criminal charges.
What kind of steps is the sheriff's office taking, if any, to make sure things stay calm and reasonable surrounding Election Day?
Well, I talked to only two of them, and they said they're not taking any particular they're not monitoring these groups or investigating these groups, but they are obviously any group with guns they would keep an eye on. They said if they're in this case, they were on 14 acres of private property. They all had permits, and so in this case, they, according to the sheriff's office, they're not breaking any laws, and they have the right to go out and fire their weapons as long as they do it safely.
My guest is reporter David Zucchino. We're talking about an increase in militia activity here in Georgia. So the first thing I thought when I saw your piece, David, was, oh, man, come on. This isn't all of Georgia. Like, people are going to see this article in the New York Times and think that Georgia is becoming a militia state. We are talking about a very tiny minority of Georgia citizens, are we not?
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, I would never say that this group represents all Georgians or all Americans. They are an extreme slice of the Trump support. And that was the idea behind the story, was to go look at the extreme supporters of Donald Trump and see what's motivating them, what they like about Trump, why they like Trump, and which way they see the country going. But in no way would they represent all people in Georgia. They are on the extreme fringe.
But did you get insight into why we have had, I think it's fair to say, relatively explosive growth in the number of militias in our nation, not just in Georgia, but in other places as well, since the election of Barack Obama?
Yeah, as I said, they have this very paranoid outlook, apocalyptic outlook, particularly if there is a, quote, liberal in the White House. They believe they are on their own. They've been forgotten, that no one will protect them unless they protect themselves.
Okay, so what insights did you come away with that perhaps were surprising to you? Did anything come as unexpected?
One thing that surprised me a bit is that, for one thing, they're not particularly enamored of Republican, so-called establishment Republicans, highly critical of them as well as with Democrats. And they, even a few of them, said they didn't like some of the things Donald Trump has done, and they particularly mentioned his comments or his attitudes and treatment of women. But on the other hand, they said they loved him for his anti-establishment views. They love the fact that he's demonized Muslims as terrorists, that he wants to keep out all Muslims, and that he wants to keep out all or wants to limit immigration. I mean, that was really what motivated them in terms of their support for Donald Trump.
Okay, that kind of relates to another thing that Ryan Lenz said. Again, Lenz is a senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor of the Hate Watch blog.
The militias are built up for the purposes of giving a solution to everyone's fear that the federal government or that the systems that surround us will collapse. But there's an additional element to that collapse that is largely part of like the ideology, which is that the federal government is a tyrannical force seeking to undermine the American people or keep them as sheep or American citizen, quote unquote, prisoners.
So what do they mention whether or not they're willing to actually fight American law enforcement or American military?
Oh, absolutely. If they came, quote, to take our guns, I mean, there's a bit of a survivalist mentality or undercurrent with this group, and part of their exercises are being able to survive in the woods, you know, with their own water and their own generators. If, you know, the tyrannical government comes and takes over and law and order breaks down. Several of them mentioned that Hillary Clinton would send U.N. troops to come disarm them.
We should mention that doesn't make any
sense. That makes absolutely no
sense.
That's what they believe, and I tried to get them to explain how that might possibly happen, but I didn't get any clear answers. And Ryan Lenz mentioned the sheep. I heard that a lot, that other people are sheep. People who don't go out and take up guns to protect themselves are sheep, and they are the lions, and they are going to protect themselves and American values and the Constitution. Many of them carry little copies of the Constitution in their pockets.
In the minute that we have left, David, did you feel more concerned when you left, or did you feel relieved now that you had a better understanding?
A little bit of both. I mean, I'm concerned that there are 276 militias out there, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, at least, and these are armed paramilitary groups, and it concerns me that there are that many people out armed and ready but ready to use their weapons if they think they are in some way attacked or marginalized. But on the other hand, these people are sort of everyday working Americans. Most of these people have jobs or they are retired and seem to like to come out on weekends and just fire their guns and run through the woods. And so I'm just hoping that's a lot of what this is about. And it was a sort of a social event, too. They all knew each other, and they get together like roughly once a month and do this. So I'm hoping some of it is just going out in the woods and shooting guns and socializing, and that they would not carry out some of the threatening talk that you hear from them.
David Zucchino is a reporter for The New York Times. You'll find a link to his article on Georgia's militias at gpbnews.org. David, thank you.
Thank you.
The presidential race is the main attraction in this year's ballot, but how do you feel about the candidates? We put that question to people on the campus of Georgia State University.
Lorraine Henderson, Stone Mountain, Georgia. Honestly, I feel like regardless, I'm not even going to lie, we screwed either way. If we vote for Trump, we screwed. If we vote for Hillary, we a little less screwed.
I'm Tony Benton Jr., and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm not a fan of either one of them. You got to make a choice. I just really don't understand how politics has become a reality show. But at the end of the day, I'm just hoping that when she gets into office, we continue to be on a pretty good note.
My name is Lamont Mosley, and I'm from Miami, Florida. I feel like it's really like a political stunt. You have somebody who's very knowledgeable and somebody who's definitely ignorant to the fact, kind of like brushing somebody's ego.
Gerald Render, Atlanta, Georgia. They're both, like, bad. So I'm voting for Hillary, but I'm just like, I gotta vote for Hillary.
Our thanks to Cree Montague for those interviews. There's a lot of disgust for major party candidates among those voices. So if you feel the same, maybe not excited about either choice, share your thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. And certainly if you have any issues with voting, we want to hear that as well. Some say a lot has changed in this country in the wake of this 2016 election, the almost wake of it. But is it better or worse? Tomorrow we'll hear from a few people in Georgia who've considered the future of the nation under a new president, whomever he or she may be. And we wonder, what has this election taught you? What has this election taught you about our country? And what has it taught you about your fellow Americans? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message to let us know your thoughts, and then be sure to join us Wednesday at 9 a.m. for more. You know, it's a job that very, very few Americans have held, 43 to be exact. There's some argument over who was the best among them, but who was the worst president? On Jimmy Kimmel Live last month, President Barack Obama read some mean tweets that were directed at him, including this one from GOP nominee Donald Trump.
President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! Exclamation point. At real Donald Trump. Well, at real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
My guest today actually disagrees with Trump. Robert Strauss says the worst American president is actually James Buchanan. He argues that point in his new book called Worst President Ever. He joins me from Philadelphia. Hi there, Robert.
Hi, I'm here at the Cradle of Liberty.
That is right. We're also joined by Ken Davis, who writes the Don't Know Much About series. That includes the book Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Ken joins us from New York. Welcome back.
Good morning, Celeste. Always a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you as well. And we're going to see if the two of you disagree on who's the worst president, maybe mix it up a little. But let's start with, Robert, with your criteria. What were the qualities or, I guess, accomplishments you were judging to try to figure out best and worst?
Well, I guess it's sort of regular. It's what they accomplished during their terms and then what the effects were after their terms.
Okay. And so that brings us to James Buchanan. Why?
James Buchanan made every wrong decision you can possibly make. But the biggest thing, I would say, is that he started the Civil War. He was really responsible for the Civil War, the most cataclysmic event in our country's history.
Although, Ken, what about the argument that Buchanan didn't start the Civil War, that the South did?
Well, we like to say the Confederacy as opposed to the South, just to be clear.
Fair enough.
May I also just suggest briefly that we put James Brown's Living in America up for national anthem as opposed to the one we currently have. It would make baseball, football games a lot more interesting. There are many, many. I happen to agree with the assessment of Buchanan, although I group them together. In Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, I ranked all 43 men from A-plus down to F, with a few incompletes thrown in. And Buchanan was certainly one of the Fs, but so were his two predecessors, Fillmore and Pierce, because I agree, Buchanan had a very, very distinct role in creating the situation, the crisis that explodes into the Civil War, especially his role in the Dred Scott decision, which we've only learned about recently. But Fillmore and Pierce are equal failures, and so in a sense is Lincoln's successor, as far as I'm concerned, Andrew Johnson, the first president, of course, to be impeached.
All right, let's hear from... Okay, so there have been a number of surveys and quizzes of historians over the years trying to rank presidents. And in almost all of them, one of the presidents coming out on top, usually in the top 3 to 5, is FDR, Roosevelt. One of the most controversial decisions he made was the creation of internment camps for Japanese Americans. So here he is as he issued a declaration of war against Japan because of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
So, Robert, how do you weigh things like that? As somebody like FDR, whom historians say was mostly a very good president, where if you're Asian American, you may not think he was all that great.
Well, you look, I have to give the answer that nobody's perfect. I mean, the Cubs won 100 and some games this year. That means they still lost 60, you know. What I would say
that
about
that is a remarkable comparison.
Since I was less studying the best than the worst, and I feel you can learn something from the worst more than you can from the best in a certain way, Buchanan made wrong turns at every moment. But here's the thing. He was the most experienced man ever to run for president. He had had almost 40 years of high government experience, senator, ambassadors, secretary of state, state house representative. But he came to office not knowing how to make a decision. And that's really the difference. When you talk about these top three, Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt, they made decisions. Now, not everybody's going to agree with your decision. You have 320 million people in the country now. No matter what the next president makes, it's not going to be loved by everybody. Buchanan did not make decisions, and that is really what led to the Civil War. And you know, just to talk about Ken's choices, I wouldn't put Fillmore there at all. He helped get the Compromise of 1850 through, which sort of forestalled the Civil War. And look, Pierce, it just didn't happen on his watch. It may have, but it didn't. So that sort of makes him less bad than Buchanan.
All right. So, I mean, since it's still too early for historians, I think, to really include Obama in any of these lists, let's hear from him. Because you were talking about everybody not being quite perfect, that is something that President Obama echoed recently when he was on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
You know, I said when I was running in 2008, I'm not a perfect man, and I wouldn't be a perfect president, but I'd make the effort to, as best I could, be honest to the American people, to make sure that I was protective of the institutions, that there were certain norms and standards and values and customs.
So, Ken, when we're talking about not being a perfect man, or eventually, at some point at least, it will be a woman, one would hope, That's a human thing. Can we evaluate presidents based on human characteristics, human failings?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. And perhaps for most of our history, we haven't done that at all.
Right.
And we've set aside some of the worst characteristics when looking at people like Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, for instance, which I did recently in a new book called In the Shadow of Liberty. We think of Washington as one of the all-time great presidents. But in fact, he was a slaveholder, as we know. And we have to balance all of his accomplishments as revolutionary commander, as first president who understood that he was setting precedent at every step along the way, with the fact that he still went home to a plantation that was entirely dependent upon slave labor. And so history is always a balancing act, and our views change as time goes by, certainly. For most of our 200-plus years, Washington was seen as flawless. We now acknowledge those flaws.
Okay, so Robert, let's talk about some of the other, I guess, potential nominees for worst president. Let me go back to the C-SPAN survey of presidential leadership. So that includes a huge group of experts, historians, and what they call professional observers of the presidency. They ranked presidents. This was as recent as 2009. And what you find is that very few modern presidents make it to either the top or the bottom of the list. In that particular survey in 2009, as you say, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, FDR were considered the three best presidents by a very large margin. But let's talk about some of the other quote unquote worst presidents. And most of them are kind of ancient history. William Henry Harrison, Warren G. Harding, Andrew Johnson, Franklin Pierce, who've already been mentioned. There's only one modern president on their list, in addition to James Buchanan, and it's this one. Here's President George W. Bush talking about the lead-up to Iraq and the claim of weapons of mass destruction there.
I wish we'd have found weapons of mass destruction. However, that doesn't make the cause a lost cause.
Right, and something that, you know, I mean, that's something you have argued. So
I believe a free Iraq is going to be transformative in the Middle East, and it's not going to happen under our lifetime. But I think somebody's going to look back someday and say, thank goodness the United States believed in the universality of freedom and liberated 25 million people and gave the Iraqis a chance to have their own free society.
President Bush there speaking with CNN host Candy Crowley. So, Robert, why do you think this is the only modern president showing up at the bottom of that list?
Because we live in the fallacy of immediacy. We cannot get out of our current situation very much. I mean, once again, you can go back to baseball. That last game of the World Series, best game of all time. Since when? Last year? You know, we tend to live in our moment. And that's why most people think that this election is so cataclysmic when I have to admit that I think that 50 years from now, we'll be looking upon this election as just one of the regular old elections.
Really? I find that very surprising. We are speaking right now with Robert Strauss, whose new book is called Worst President Ever, and historian Ken Davis, who writes the Don't Know Much About series. But I can't let that go, Robert, because so many things about this election are precedent setting. You think this, that may, wait, let me, I guess, dig into what you mean by that. Do you mean we have established a new norm and 50 years from now this will seem normal? Or do you think that this election is not exceptional?
I think it's not exceptional. I think that if you look at history, which Ken and I have, and that doesn't make us better people for it. I'm not saying that. But, you probably studied history in high school, maybe even in college, and you go by this country so fast. Washington started the country. Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Lincoln freed the slaves. It goes by so fast. You forget when you look at the 4 years of any president or 8 years among those who had two terms, that lots of things happened. And I will bet you that if you have a great-grandchild 70 years from now, he comes home to his mother and says, you're not going to believe it. In 2016, a lot of the people thought the president was born in Kenya. It's such a big thing that we know now, but it will be nothing many years from now. I really think so. And you can go back and look at many other things in other elections. I'm sure Ken can tell you that.
Well, let me move on, though, and go further into this idea of worst president, because the view of the average American on who's the worst is very different from historians. Here is somebody who appears on most average citizens' list of worst presidents, but not in the bottom five for historians. This is President Richard Nixon delivering his resignation speech in 1974.
To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad.
Ken, why is the opinion of historians and the opinion of regular Americans so divergent here?
It's a great question, and two quick points. First of all, Nixon, for his a singular event in presidential history of resigning, is still balanced somewhat by the extraordinary advances he achieved in foreign policy, specifically opening up China. And of course, Richard Nixon, the anti-communist, going back to his days in the 1940s and 50s, was probably the only president who could have done that successfully. So he gets extra credit for that. I moved him from F to D in my ranking of the presidents. But to George Bush particular, just very quickly, I think most presidents are viewed on two points. Above all, the handling of the economy. How did the country do? Pocketbook issues,
right,
and issues of war. How did the president respond by making the most fateful decision, which is putting American lives in harm's way? And on those two counts alone, the handling of the economy and the war in Iraq, George Bush has to be judged one of the great failures in American history, in my opinion.
Okay, I've been speaking with Robert Strauss and Ken Davis. Robert's new book is called Worst President Ever. Ken is the author of Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Thanks so much to both of you.
Tomorrow
Thank
is another day.
Thank you so day. Much for having us.
Since so many people are voting today, we thought it would be good to take a look at the history of the iconic little sticker that you get when you vote here in Georgia, the Georgia voter sticker.
My name is Candace Brose, and I'm the press secretary for Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp. Georgia's voting sticker actually originated with an idea from former Secretary of State Max Cleland, but it was different than the one that we currently use. The first version of the sticker was red, white, and blue, and it had text that said, "I have voted, have you?" A bit later on, there was another sticker that looked like a Georgia license plate, an older version. It read, "I voted," and honestly, it actually would generate quite a bit of complaints from voters. It was a very large sticker, would take up a significant amount of space on your clothing. And the adhesive was notorious for leaving residue on your clothes. Ann Hicks is a retired employee from the Georgia Secretary of State's office who really worked through every single role in the division you could possibly imagine and worked her way up to elections director. She got a call one day from an irate constituent, and what this individual relayed to her was that he had gone and voted and gotten the larger Georgia license plate version of the sticker, and he'd forgotten to take it off before he took his shirt to be professionally dry cleaned. And as a result, it ruined the shirt. He demanded payment, you know, that the elections division needed to compensate him for the shirt, and Ann Hicks was very respectful but declined. Now it's funny. For her at the time, it probably wasn't very fun to deal with. It was in 1998 when then Secretary of State Louis Massey had the idea to update the sticker. But actually, it was Kathy Cox who finalized the idea when she became Secretary of State. Ms. Hicks, who was an employee here in the transition, she was in charge of the print orders back then and was the one that actually ordered the first batch of the new peach voting sticker. They spent a lot of time when they finally decided they wanted the peach to make sure they got that peach color exactly right. And so once they did, they put that into effect, and that's the one we use right now. This year, we have ordered and received 3.15 million Georgia peach voting stickers. I do want to point out that we place these orders so regularly, and we send them to counties, but counties also have stockpiled stickers because no one wants to run out of that sticker.
That's Candace Brose, the press secretary for the Georgia Secretary of State. Remember, GPB's election coverage begins at 8 p.m., 1 hour after polls close, and we'll have all the information that you need for your election day. Also remember, if you haven't already, go vote. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.